There's a handout going around that consists of two parts. One part is an overview of the field of apologetics, which is the field of Christian philosophy or theology that I'm interested in. Apologetics is that branch of Christian theology that tries to provide a rational justification for Christianity's truth claims. And it consists of both a positive or offensive element and a negative or defensive element. And the outline lists some of the principal issues involved in both offensive and defensive apologetics. Then in addition to that, there's a bibliography that goes around that hits some of the best work in each of these different areas. And so I give that to you for your future reference. I want to refer to a couple of other things that may be of interest to you. One of the most important parts of offensive or positive apologetics is natural theology, which is the demonstration or argument that God exists that doesn't appeal to authoritative, divine, special revelation. And we'll be talking about one such argument in today's seminar. But I wanted to alert you to the fact that the cover story of Christianity Today for July carries an article on this called God Is Not Dead Yet. The editors of Christianity Today asked me to write an article on the renaissance that is going on among contemporary analytic Anglo-American philosophers with regard to arguments for God's existence. And they liked the article I wrote so much, they put it on the cover story. And so this describes the movement among contemporary philosophers to refurbish and redefend the arguments for God's existence. And it lists some of those arguments. So I would commend the article to you as something that would be of interest to you. The other thing I want to mention that isn't on the bibliography that's going around is my book, Reasonable Faith, which just came out a week ago in a brand new third edition, which is completely updated and revised, and contains a detailed account of the material I'm going to share with you this morning. In our brief time together, 35 minutes, we can only outline this argument for God's existence. But if you're interested, if it piques your interest, look at Reasonable Faith in the chapter on the existence of God, and you'll find the argument defended in greater detail. I would also say that you could look at the website reasonablefaith.org, which has reams of free material on there, debate transcripts, downloadable articles, podcasts, question of the week, an open forum, lots of free material on the website reasonablefaith.org that will supplement this seminar as well as the book. So what we want to talk about in this seminar today, and maybe you could indicate to me, Mr. Timekeeper, no, I don't need that. What I was going to say is, don't tell me just when we're going to end, but tell me when I've got, say, 15 minutes left, because I want to have time for discussion. Okay. So let me know when there's 15 minutes left. Okay. But we want to talk today about a particular argument for God's existence that was developed by the 18th century German philosopher and mathematician Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Leibniz said that the most fundamental question that needs to be asked is the following. Why is there something rather than nothing? That is to say, why does anything at all exist instead of just nothing? This was a question that I have asked myself ever since I was a little boy. I remember as a child looking up at the stars at night and saying, where did all of this come from? There must be a reason why everything exists. And little did I know that as a boy, I had stumbled onto one of the most profound metaphysical questions that has troubled mankind ever since the days of ancient Greek philosophers. And I think that we can put this reasoning into an argument that will make the logic very clear and is easily memorizable so that we can share it with others. And Leibniz's argument would basically go like this. Premise one is everything that exists has an explanation for its existence. Everything that exists has an explanation for its existence. Premise two, if the universe has an explanation for its existence, that explanation is God. So premise two is, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, That explanation is God. The third premise of the argument is the universe exists. The universe exists. That's it. That's the argument. Those are the three premises. Now, what follows logically from those three premises? Well, consider premises 1 and 3. If everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, and the universe exists, then it follows logically that 4, this is the fourth step in the argument, therefore the universe has an explanation of its existence. Now, recall that premise 2 says that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. And premise 4, or step 4 of the argument, has concluded that the universe does have an explanation of its existence. So from steps 2 and 4, it follows logically, therefore, the explanation of the universe's existence is God. So to recap, the argument goes like this. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. The universe exists. Therefore, the universe has an explanation of its existence. Finally, step 5, therefore, the explanation of the universe's existence is God. Now, this is a logically airtight argument. That is to say, if the premises are true, then the conclusion follows with logical necessity. It is unavoidable. It doesn't matter if you don't like the conclusion. It doesn't matter if you have other objections to God's existence. So long as you grant the three premises, the conclusion is unavoidable. It follows with logical necessity. So, if someone, one of our agnostic or atheist friends, wants to reject the argument's conclusion, he must reject one of those three premises. He must do so if he's to avoid the conclusion. But which one will he reject? Well, premise 3, I think, is undeniable for anybody who's a sincere inquirer after truth. Obviously, the universe exists. So the argument's detractor is going to have to deny either premise 1 or premise 2. And so the whole question about this argument comes down to this. Are premises 1 and 2 true or are they false? Note that they don't have to be known with certainty in order for this to be a good argument. So long as they're simply more plausibly true than false, then we should believe in them rather than their negations, rather than the opposite. So, are those two premises more plausibly true than false? Well, let's take a look briefly at each one of these premises. Take a look at the first premise, that that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. Now, at first blush, this premise might seem to be vulnerable in a rather obvious way. If everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, then it follows that if God exists, then God must have an explanation of his existence. But that seems absurd because the explanation of God's existence would then have to be some other being that is greater than God. And that's impossible. So it would seem to follow premise 1 must be false. Some things must be able to exist without any explanation. And the theist will say God exists inexplicably. But the atheist will say, well, then why not just stop with the universe? The universe just exists inexplicably. And so we seem to be in a stalemate. Well, what I would say here is not so fast. This rather obvious objection to premise 1 is based upon a misunderstanding of what Leibniz meant by an explanation. In Leibniz's thinking, there are basically two kinds of things or entities that exist. Either things which exist necessarily or things that are produced by some external cause. Let's explain each of these. First, things which exist necessarily exist by a necessity of their own nature. It's impossible for them not to exist. Examples. Well, many mathematicians think that numbers and sets and other mathematical objects exist in this way. Mathematical entities, like numbers, aren't caused to exist by something else. They just exist by the necessity of their own nature. Now, by contrast, things that exist contingently, that is to say non-necessarily, are caused to exist by some external cause. They exist because something else has produced them. Examples? Well, familiar physical objects like chairs and people and galaxies and nebular systems exist because they have external causes of their existence. So, premise one could actually be reworded in Leibniz's thinking to say that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. That's what he really means by premise one. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. But now the objection falls to the ground, for the explanation of God's existence lies in the necessity of his own nature. As even the atheist recognizes, it's impossible for God to have a cause. And so Leibniz's argument is really an argument for the existence of God as a necessarily existent being. So far from undermining Leibniz's argument, the atheist's initial objection actually helps to clarify and magnify who God is. If God exists, he is a necessarily existing, uncaused being. So that objection to premise one, I think, falls to the ground. So the question then is, well, what reason might be offered for thinking that premise one is true? Well, when you reflect on it, I think that premise one has a sort of self-evidence about it. Imagine, for example, that you're hiking in the mountains, and as you go through the woods, you come across a translucent ball lying on the forest floor. Now, you would naturally wonder how that ball came to be there. If one of your hiking partners said to you, "Oh, don't worry about it, it just exists inexplicably," you would either think that he was crazy or else that he just wanted you to keep moving. But you wouldn't take seriously the suggestion that the ball existed there with literally no explanation. Well, suppose we increase the size of the ball in our story so that it's as big as a car. Wouldn't make any difference. That wouldn't do anything to satisfy or remove the demand of an explanation of its existence. Suppose it were the size of a house. Well, same problem. Suppose it were the size of a continent or a planet. Same problem. Suppose it were the size of the entire universe. Same problem. Merely increasing the size of the ball does nothing to affect the need of an explanation. So if it is correct that the ball needs an explanation of its existence, similarly, everything else, even the entire universe, would need an explanation of why it exists. I'm going to skip the next part in the interest of time. And go on to premise two. There's more issues that could be raised, but let's talk about premise two in the interest of time. What about premise two, that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God? Is this premise more plausibly true than false? Well, what's really awkward for the atheist at this point is that premise two is logically equivalent to what the atheist normally says in response to Leibniz's argument. Now, what do I mean when I say they're logically equivalent? Well, two statements are logically equivalent if it's impossible for one to be true and the other to be false. Two statements are logically equivalent if it's impossible for one to be true and the other to be false. In other words, they stand or fall together. They're either both true or they're both false, but they cannot differ in their truth value if they're logically equivalent. Now, what does the atheist almost always say in response to Leibniz's argument? Well, typically what the atheist says is that if atheism is true, then the universe has no explanation of its existence. If atheism is true, The universe has no explanation of its existence. The atheist typically says the universe just exists, inexplicably, and that's all. But you see, that is logically equivalent to saying if the universe has an explanation of its existence, then atheism is not true. Those are logically equivalent statements. The first statement says if atheism is true, then the universe has no explanation of its existence. The second one says if the universe has an explanation of its existence, then atheism is not true. Can you see the logical equivalence between the two? The first one says P implies Q. The other one says not Q implies not P. So they're logically equivalent statements. So you cannot affirm the one without affirming the other. The problem is the statement that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, then atheism is not true, is virtually synonymous to premise two of the argument. Remember, which says that if the universe has an explanation of its existence, then that explanation is God. So the typical atheist response to Leibniz is actually logically equivalent to premise two, so that the atheist himself sees the intuitive truth of premise two. But besides that, premise two is very plausible, I think, in its own right. For think of what the universe is. All of space-time reality, all matter and energy, all of space and time. So it follows that if the universe has a cause of its existence, that cause must be a non-physical, immaterial being which transcends both space and time. This is really amazing. Now, there are only two kinds of object or entity that could fit that sort of description. Either an abstract object, like a number, which is immaterial, non-physical, and beyond space and time, or else an unembodied mind. And by a mind, I mean a self, what in theology we call a soul, an immaterial mental entity. But the problem is that of these two alternatives, abstract objects can't cause anything. The number seven, for example, can't cause anything. Numbers are causally effete. They're impotent. So it follows that the cause of the universe must be an unembodied, transcendent mind, which is exactly what theists take God to be. So I hope you begin to grasp here the power of Leibniz's argument. If it is successful, it proves the existence of a necessary, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, personal creator of the universe. This is no vaguely conceived and ill-defined flying spaghetti monster. Rather, this is the God of classical theism. This is really mind-blowing. So I think this is a very powerful argument for God's existence. Much more can be said about it, and I do say this about it in the book Reasonable Faith, but to allow time for discussion, I'm going to end the defense of the argument. Given those three premises, it follows that God exists. So what argument or objection or discussion or question do you have at this point? Yes.
Is it possible that the atheist would argue that the explanation has not yet been discovered?
Yes.
Is that also logically equivalent to your second premise, as you pointed out?
No, it would not. It would not be. They would deny the second premise and say, well, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, it's something that science hasn't yet discovered. And I find among popular level atheists, this is a very frequent claim. I think, however, it fails to understand what one is looking for here. We're looking for an explanation for why all of space-time reality exists, why all of physical reality exists. So when you think about it, that can't be a scientific or material explanation, because anything like that would itself be part of space-time reality. We're looking for something that has to be beyond that. So the person who says that is just reacting in the typical sort of, well, that's a God of the gaps argument, holding out for some naturalistic yet undiscovered scientific explanation. And they don't really understand the argument that we're looking for something here that would explain why anything at all exists. And therefore, it can't be found in some sort of a, say, multiverse or prior physical cause of the Big Bang, because then Leibniz's argument will just work all over again. We've got to get something that transcends space and time and exists necessarily. Yes?
In the nature of explanation, objection has been pressed is explanation isn't explanation unless it's predictive, or this person would allow predictive. And God isn't predictive of anything in a statistical sense that this particular scientifically minded person is pressed this objection. So the nature of explanation is in question there. Is it explanatory to say God did it when you can't produce a prediction out of that?
I think that prediction is only important for scientific explanations, and this isn't a scientific argument. This is a philosophical argument. This is not physics. This is metaphysics. And so the scientist who tries to impose the condition of predictability or empirical testability upon the philosopher is transgressing the realms of his discipline. He's assuming that somehow scientific criteria are the only criteria for assessing arguments, and that just, I think, is false. For example, in mathematics, you have explanations that don't involve testability in the sense of making predictions that are then verified. You can explain something by means of axioms from which these theorems follow, and those are not meant to be causal explanations that involve empirical predictability. So I can grant, for the sake of argument, I don't even need to address whether or not predictability is a necessary condition of scientific explanation. I'm happy to concede that. But I'm not a scientist. I'm a philosopher, and this is a metaphysical argument. And I think quite clearly to posit a transcendent necessary cause of the existence of anything that exists is not only explanatorily sufficient, but it's even necessary, as I say. The argument given premise one requires that there be such a thing. Yes, in the way back.
I'm wondering if there's an atheist might push back and say, like with regard to the first premise, just insist that the universe does exist necessarily by according to its nature.
Good point. I deal with that in the material that I've omitted. This is an argument that very few atheists have been willing to take, because what it requires you to say is that the universe exists necessarily. And that seems extremely counterintuitive, that it seems like things in the universe didn't have to exist, that the universe didn't have to exist. We can imagine a world, a possible world where only, say, mathematical objects exist, and there is no space and time or physical reality. And so if the atheist is going to say that's an impossibility, then he has some sort of burden to make that, give us a reason for that. In other words, as one of my friends say, possibilities come cheap. What we're really interested in is plausibility, and so he need to defend that. And I don't know of any reason to think that that's plausible, to think the universe exists by a necessity of its own nature. Moreover, I would say that we do have good grounds for thinking the universe doesn't exist by a necessity of its own nature. And one argument I would give is that none of the things that make the universe up seem to be existing necessarily. Planets, people, galaxies, dust, radiation, none of these things seem to exist necessarily. In fact, in the very distant past, none of those things did exist. Now, somebody might say, well, what about the quarks that make up matter? Maybe they exist by a necessity of their own nature. But to me, it seems incredible to think that every single quark in the universe exists by a necessity of its own nature, that just this collection of quarks is the only possible collection of quarks that could have existed. That seems to me fantastic. And yet, if a different collection of quarks did exist, then a different universe would exist. This universe doesn't exist necessarily. Moreover, and here's my last point, we have now, I think, good evidence that the universe had a beginning, that the universe came into being and is therefore not eternal. And one of the conditions of existing necessarily is existing eternally. Anything that comes into being doesn't exist by a necessity of its own nature. And therefore, the contingency of the universe, I think, is also underlined by its temporal finitude. So those would be reasons that I outline in more detail in the book to try to respond to that possible atheistic riposte. Yes?
How would you deal with a person who say that the cause or the reason, you know, what's behind the Big Bang is that cause of everything is something that exists in the center?
Well, I think that's right.
It's not God.
Well, but again, I would respond in the same way that I responded to someone else who just asked that, this would have to be a transcendent, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, necessary thing, and the only things that we know that could be like that are either mathematical objects or a mind. But mathematical objects aren't involved in causal relationships, so they can't be the cause of the universe. So it must be a transcendent mind. Let me just make one more point, and note that this is not an argument based on looking for a cause of the Big Bang. Leibniz's argument was formulated when it was thought that the universe is eternal. This was an 18th century argument. So this doesn't presuppose the universe has a beginning. Leibniz would say even if the universe has existed forever, we can still ask the question, why is there something rather than nothing? So why does an eternal universe exist? The argument based on the beginning of the universe is an independent argument. Yes?
How does this relate to the argument that some years ago say that, well, if the universe is complex and there's a creator, that would be more complex, so why don't we just stop with
mm-hmm. This isn't related to that argument directly because it's not a design argument. That was an objection that Richard Dawkins raises to design arguments by saying that if the complex order of the universe requires an explanation, then the explanation is even more complex than the complex universe, and therefore no explanatory advance is made. But that's irrelevant to this argument because we're not trying to explain the complexity of the universe. As for why Dawkins' argument is fallacious, take a look at the Question of the Week archive at my website, reasonablefaith.org. The number one question when we opened the website over a year ago was on Dawkins' central argument of his book, The God Delusion, which is this argument, and I explain why that is not a good objection to design arguments. Yes? Okay. Notice that premise one, as I've stated it, does not say that every fact has an explanation or that every truth has an explanation. That would be a more radical version of what's called the principle of sufficient reason and would be vulnerable to this objection. Premise one, as I've stated, is more modest. It just says anything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. So it's compatible with there being truths or facts for which there are no explanation, brute facts, for example. But what it says there can't be is something, some actual object that exists that has no explanation of its existence at all. And I would just reiterate the defense I gave of premise one as to why that's quite plausible. So that objection would be pertinent to, I think, even Leibniz's own statement. He had a more radical statement of premise one, but it wouldn't be pertinent to the argument as I framed it. How are we doing on time-wise, Mr. Timekeeper? Pardon me?
About three, 4 more minutes.
Okay. Someone who hasn't asked a question first.
I have two atheists, and one is...
And your question is?
No.
Well, use this argument with the first guy. I mean, one apologetic argument doesn't have to fit all. This other fellow needs more help in Well, I don't know what his mindset is. I mean, I think what you... Yes, what you would probably have to do with somebody like that is try to persuade him that his view is self-defeating, that it undermines itself so that you don't even need to argue against it because it itself contains the seeds of its own destruction. He is like the person who says, I can't speak a word of English. Yeah, well, you know, that person may be only reachable through prayer. because of it's a darkened intellect, frankly. I mean, if he can't understand the problem in a self-defeating affirmation, then he's just in real dire straits. And you may need to try to reach him relationally, say, through being there for him when his wife divorces him or his child is killed in a car accident or something. You know, you may reach him in another way. But I would share with him the self-defeating nature of his position and explain how it's self-defeating, like the person who says he can't speak English or something of that sort. And then if he fails to see it, that's his own problem. And you've done your duty as a Christian apologist and now need to just be there as a loving friend and Christian companion. Yes?
You mentioned drilling down the quarks.
Yes.
A moment ago. How helpful do you think are quantum mechanics today, the search for the new Bison particle, the God particle that's been called recently in National Geographic, these sorts of things? I mean, if we're going to talk about transcendence in space and time, uh-huh. It seems like the further we go in that area, the more it's helping us. Is that true, or is that just popular?
I wouldn't be impressed by labels like the God particle for the Higgs particle that they're trying to find. I think this is just one more of these colorful scientific names that can be very misleading. But I do think it is important for the contemporary apologist to have an understanding of quantum mechanics and this field of physics. It can be challenging as well as helpful. I mean, there are interpretations of that which seem to lead to observer-dependent reality. And indeterminism and things of that sort. So it can be challenging as well as helpful. So I think we need to be familiar with it, but I haven't seen that it carries some kind of great theological freight that I have found especially helpful. So I've yet to see that, I suppose. All right, well, we're out of time, but thank you for coming. And again, I would commend to you the book if you're interested in learning more about this particular argument.